I'm Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway, and thanks for spending some time with us today. I recently tweeted about something I called a, quote, pandemic wall, the burnout from working nonstop, no break from the news, childcare, and isolation. And according to my social media feeds, tens of thousands of you are feeling the same. From Hawaii to Spain, many of you got in touch with me to say that you were feeling it too, hitting this wall as the weight of work, economic uncertainty, isolation, and everything else just keeps piling on top of us, all while living through a deadly global pandemic. And what we're feeling is different than a kind of pandemic fatigue, where you're just tired of wearing a mask or social distancing. This is something a little deeper. It's a feeling of total exhaustion and of being so overwhelmed that it's hard to see the light ahead. Now, for months, here on the show, we've been talking about the growing mental health pandemic happening alongside the COVID-19 crisis. And according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, 53% of adults said that the pandemic was having a negative impact on their mental health. Now, as we pass the one-year mark of COVID-19 here in the United States, I want to check in on that and to understand why so many of us are hitting the pandemic wall now, and more importantly, how we can find some relief. I'm joined by Dr. Jessica Stern, a clinical psychologist and clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU Langone Health. Dr. Stern, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Dr. Suzanne Song is the director of the Division of Child, Adolescent, and Family Psychiatry at the George Washington University Medical Center. Dr. Song, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Dr. Song, why did my tweet get so many responses?
I think it's because clearly you resonated with so many people, and many people right now are feeling ashamed and isolated with their feelings, but everybody is depleted. We are exhausted. We can't focus. There's no motivation. People have lost their jobs. They want work, or they're working and it's too much work. So while these terms are going around, like you mentioned, the pandemic fatigue and burnout, the pandemic wall, as you've described, people are wondering if they're depressed. So burnout, I think, just to define a little bit, it's when we're exhausted, we're detached, we have lower productivity, we have a sense of ineffectiveness. And a common metaphor for burnout is of a battery running out. So if you have a toy, the battery runs out, the toy stops working. But let's say you're a parent. There's no parent that can just stop parenting. So the best thing that I've heard around burnout is from someone named Dr. Drummond. He's an expert on physician burnout. So he relates burnout to a bank account for your energy. So at the bank, if you overdraw your account, they don't close your account. They charge you fines and interest. So they actually accelerate your downward spiral when you go below zero. And I feel like that's what the pandemic, the politics, the social violence, that's what it's been doing. It's dipping into our emotional reserves.
And a lot of people are feeling that way. Dr. Stern, some of the responses to this were interesting. And I just sort of, you know, tweeted this off the top of my head, really. And I was shocked to see so many people responding. But a lot of people were saying that the fact that you could name it was comforting. Is it important, Dr. Stern, to name what we're feeling? Does that help us feel better, or at least to start to feel better?
Absolutely. I think what you did so beautifully is you took this very deep, dark, vague feeling that people were experiencing, and you put a name to it, and you helped people identify what it was that they were experiencing. And I think it's sort of like having this dark cloud over your head that you don't really know exactly what it is, but when you're able to spot it and say, ah, that's what it is, that's what I'm experiencing, it makes it feel a little bit less scary because you know what's happening for you. And it's also so validating because then you can explain it to other people and share that sentiment with other people. And it doesn't feel like this random, unexpected experience that people are having. And so putting a face to the name can be so extremely powerful for people. And I thank you for doing that in that tweet.
And I'm wondering, Dr. Stern, is there something about, it almost feels like people were somewhat ashamed, and sort of pivoting off of what Dr. Song was saying about, you know, lifting, you know, pointing this out and a lot of people feeling like they're falling behind. Is there something endemic to our culture in the United States that makes us hesitant to say, you know, these things, to say, look, I'm hurting and I'm not doing well?
Absolutely. I think there are a couple of pieces here that are particularly powerful and relevant. I think the first one is that we as a society still have a long way to go in terms of reducing stigma related to mental health. And we are, in general, a very go-go-go society, which has its blessings for sure. But I think that oftentimes for people, when they feel like they can't do the things that they want to do, or they can't achieve, or it feels like they can't stay on top of the various different responsibilities that they have, they feel like they're failing, or they feel like there's something wrong with them. Or something I hear often is, it feels like I'm broken. And I think that can be really upsetting for people. And what happens with shame is, when we don't talk about it, it feeds the shame, which then prevents us from talking about it and creates this very nasty cycle. Brené Brown has talked a lot about this. And I think it can be challenging. And I think what happened at the beginning of the pandemic is a lot of people were excited about how they can use their time and, you know, sourdough starters and using their time to be more productive. And while those were helpful coping mechanisms, I think there were a lot of people who were feeling overwhelmed by the fact that they actually couldn't be so productive because, of course, they were stressed and anxious and hopeless and helpless. And so I think seeing this, you know, sentiment around them where it seems like everyone else was keeping it together when in fact that wasn't really true, I think really fostered a lot more shame in people that took a lot of time for people to be open about.
Dr. Song, I want to pick up on that idea because I'm wondering, how has our mental health collectively, and of course, all of us are individuals with unique circumstances, but have you noticed a shift in how people, at least generally, have felt about the pandemic at the, you know, in the spring versus how they're feeling now?
Yeah, I think we are experiencing a collective demoralization. And I have had so many of my patients, my friends, my family just asking if we are clinically depressed, because we're still, you know, I think many people think this pandemic has been almost 1 year. We know now there's a new normal. We're all, you know, we're all used to finding out ways to get our groceries, and still we're feeling really incompetent. So I think it's important to distinguish between being demoralized and being clinically depressed. They both make us want to stay in bed all day, make it hard to concentrate, motivate. But depression, true clinical depression, is an individual biological problem. Demoralization is due to the society in which we live. So I think collectively we're feeling demoralized.
And Dr. Song, one of the interesting things about the tweet was that I got responses from parents who could identify, but there were also people who said, look, I don't even have kids and I'm feeling like this. Or there were people who were elderly folks who said, look, I feel totally isolated. One woman said she had lost her husband, that this was, you know, a very difficult year. Someone else reached out and said they were struggling, you know, with you know, really heavy issues that were surrounding depression, et cetera. So are there certain groups of people who might be feeling this more than others right now?
Yeah, so the studies right now are showing there are three groups that are popping up. So for the first are young people. The UN defines youth as age 18 to 25 years old. And developmentally, it makes sense. You know, youth need peers to interact, to shape their identities and who they want to become, who they are. Peers are everything in that age group. I'm seeing that in my clinical practice. Most of my young people, so the kids who are either their seniors in high school or they're in their first years of college, those are kind of my most serious cases right now. They're suicidal, actively suicidal, and really struggling. The second group are Black and Hispanic individuals. And that's also kind of understandable. They're witnessing their communities be disposable by law enforcement, by healthcare, education, by the pandemic. And then the third category right now are essential workers, because they're experiencing this vicarious trauma at witnessing the massive loss of death on top of the demoralization when people aren't really taking the pandemic seriously.
Dr. Stern, one of the things that really hit me was the length of this pandemic. And it happened, you know, I gave birth weeks before the pandemic really hit the United States. And it hit home for me now that I have a close to 1-year-old child, how long this has been going on. Is the length of the pandemic contributing to how we're feeling collectively?
Most definitely. There's a level of chronicity now that we've hit where this has become a chronic problem. And the more time goes on, the more time we feel that fatigue building and building. And while we do have this opportunity to learn from it as time goes on, at the same time, it's sort of like compounding interest. So to go back to Dr. Song's analogy before, is the interest keeps growing. And it feels like we are drastically having to change our lives in a way that no longer feels temporary. And this is very, very exhausting for individuals. And many people are going a long span of time without seeing loved ones. And the more time that goes on, the more we're feeling the permanence of this all. And even if we do come out of this at some point in the next couple of years, it feels very fatiguing because it's built up for such a long span of time, which is very overwhelming for people.
Of course, we also need to acknowledge that we are in January, which is a month that I think typically for many people, there's something called Blue Monday, which is, you know, one of the quote unquote saddest days of the year people talk about in January. It's the post-holiday slump. Is that also exacerbating this, Dr. Stern?
Yes, for sure. So we know that winter can be a very hard time for people in general, even pre-pandemic. So oftentimes people will have the seasonal blues, or in a much more clinical capacity will have what's called seasonal affective disorder, where, you know, it's cold in a lot of parts of the world and it's darker, and people definitely experience more sadness or more loneliness or things like this. And when you have that on top of the pandemic, it definitely creates a lot more of that that difficulty, that struggle that people are having. And so having to navigate both of those at the same time is difficult. And I think for a lot of people in parts of the world, there was this opportunity in the summer and fall to sort of re-engage with some activities by being outdoors and things like this. And it felt a little bit nice for a couple of moments in some places, and to have to go back to being very isolated in cold places for a lot of parts of the world is just very overwhelming and definitely creates a lot of exacerbation of the isolation. So definitely dual struggles.
Dr. Song, you made a distinction earlier that I'd love to dig into a little bit. You said that there's a difference between being demoralized and having clinical depression. How can people tell the difference?
When we are demoralized, it's a subjective incompetence and a hopelessness that we feel when we witness or have to engage in something that goes against our moral compass. It's kind of an existential distress. So when we are feeling really down because innocent people are being murdered because of their skin color, or we have someone threatening our very democracy in an insurgence, or our kids can't feel safe going to school, or there's conflation with pleasure, with being irresponsible about the pandemic, public health measures. These are all moral challenges that leave us in despair. But clinical depression is when we have a lot of negative self-talk. You know, we can't stand who we are, we feel worthless, we dislike everybody, and there's really very little relief. There's no periods of laughing, no energy to get out of bed, let alone exercise. Whereas in demoralization, we can still have moments of happiness. You know, we still love our friends, our family, and we can still go out for a run, but we're just feeling an existential despair.
And Dr. Stern, those moments of, you know, hope, I think a lot of folks were saying to me that they were hoping that the minute, you know, the clock turned to 2021, and the administration, the presidential administration changed, and potentially a vaccine was on the horizon, that things were going to change. Is that giving people some hope? Is there spark for a hope with that? I mean, are expectations in line with reality there?
There definitely is a lot of hope. And I think, like you're talking about, a lot of people are looking for markers of change and almost anchors to look to know that something new is coming around the corner. And thankfully, we have a couple of those in terms of government, in terms of vaccine, obviously the new year. And so it's giving people a little bit more energy to kind of get started and to look forward to what's yet to come. The struggle is that obviously all of these things are going to take some time. And so I think some people were hoping for almost the sense of magic that things were going to come back to normal or change rather quickly. And it's going to take a little bit more time there. So there's a little bit of patience that's required, but definitely there is something to look forward to. Absolutely.
And then, Dr. Song, given that the pandemic isn't going to end tomorrow, how do we put together a toolkit to navigate this reality, especially if we're not feeling so great? Is it a day-by-day thing? Is it an hour-by-hour thing? Is there a longer-term way that we should be thinking?
Yeah, I think, you know, just to build off of the hope, you know, hope is one thing that people are turning to right now. And I think we have to remember that hope is it's something you do, not necessarily something you feel. And so it's okay to build a practice of hope where we're intentionally trying to move towards not avoiding by like sleeping in bed all the time or opening up that second bag of Oreos, but we're actually engaging in life. And it doesn't mean we're engaging actively physically necessarily, because that's very hard for a lot of people right now who are feeling down. It means that we engage with ourselves, with who we know ourselves to be. So we build hope as a practice. We think about our own values. You know, this pandemic has led to demoralization in part because the pandemic has tested our values as a society. You know, will we look out for each other? Will we sacrifice others for our own gain? Will we put the interests of the economy over the wider whole? Will our leaders rise to the challenge, or will they play political games? You know, we should think about how we want to answer all of these questions and enact our values. And so all of that can help to create a practice of hope.
And Dr. Stern, for those people who are listening right now who might say, you know, I think I'm more than demoralized, or I'm feeling like I'm slipping into something else that doesn't feel familiar, but definitely doesn't feel good. Are there resources that people should consider?
Definitely. I think now is a wonderful time to seek out therapy or counseling of some sort, potentially psychiatry for medication consultation and management. And now can be really the best time to invest in those types of things and to take care of your mental health moving forward. And I like to think about it as almost like we go to the dentist to either prevent cavities or to prevent new cavities. And so too, we should be taking care of our mental health in very much the same way. And you can build these toolkits for yourself that you can use for the rest of your life. And so seeking out a mental health provider can be extremely helpful. And in order to do that, there are a couple of ways that you can do that. One is to visit Psychology Today, where you can put in information about your insurance and your location and any specifications that you have for the type of therapy you're looking for. You can also go through your insurance panel if you have insurance, or also see if you have out-of-network benefits to visit a local outpatient clinic or a mental health center. Also, word of mouth can be truly helpful, and to look for a couple of different nonprofit organizations that are available for typically underrepresented individuals. And so there are beautiful organizations that are emerging for therapy for Black girls or individuals who are underrepresented in terms of economic status or veterans or things like this. And so please feel free to use the internet as your resource and look for some of these wonderful nonprofit organizations that are popping up and have also long existed, because there might be a really good fit for you out there for sure.
Dr. Jessica Stern is a clinical psychologist and clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at NYU Langone Health. And Dr. Suzanne Song is the director of the Division of Child, Adolescent, and Family Psychiatry at the George Washington University Medical Center. And if you or someone you know is having suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-8255, or text HOME to the crisis text line at 741-741.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Around the country, the pandemic is causing rising tensions between teachers, unions, and school districts. In Chicago, the local government decided to reopen the city, but in response, the teachers' union voted to delay in-person teaching, demanding more protections and vaccinations before they head back into the classroom. And in other places like Austin, Texas, teachers began in-person teaching earlier this month, even though the union adamantly opposed the move. All of this is not just affecting teachers, but students as well, with working class students of color disproportionately affected. We're going to talk about the national picture for teachers in just a few moments. But first, we go to Texas for one teacher's experience with all of this. Mario Pina is an eighth grade English teacher in Austin, Texas. Mario, thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what's your experience been teaching this past year in Austin?
You know, I think my experience is similar to most teachers this year. It's been absolutely crazy, right? I'm in my eighth year teaching, and I think a lot of us feel like it's our first year teaching. Things are completely different. They're not what we normally do. Even people as confident as I was in the past have had a bit of a struggle kind of adjusting to virtual learning, trying to teach students in our classes and online simultaneously. It's been a really big change for us.
Who are the students that you teach? What's their demographic profile?
So I teach in a low-income area. It's a Title I school, mostly Black and brown kids. And so, you know, they're being affected probably the most out of anybody, I think.
Tell me about the COVID spikes around your community. Are you seeing them? Are they stabilized? What does the COVID infection rate look like right now?
Yeah, so I think that especially within the past 2 to 3 weeks, we've seen a big spike within not just our community within my school, but Austin as a whole. Recently, we went into stage 5, which set a whole new set of parameters around how we socialize, what can be open at what time. And so that spike has really kind of affected school. We went from having students have the option of either being in person or online to what the district likes to say, encouraging students to stay home. Not necessarily saying that they should stay home or that they need to stay home, but they were highly encouraging it. So because of that, we did have a decrease in students coming in person. And we did that for 2 weeks, but then this week we took away that highly encouragement. We had a lot of students come back.
What has Education Austin, which is the teachers union, said about returning to school? What's their position been?
Yeah, so their position is that they want to make sure that we are staying safe, try to stay home as much as we can until the pandemic is a little bit better. You know, we are highly asking the teachers be put at the front line for the vaccination, and not just our teachers, but our staff as well, bus drivers, our cafeteria staff, anybody who's working directly with the kids, because they're on the front lines right now.
Mario, what actions has the union taken to challenge the district specifically?
So at the beginning of the pandemic, we were urging everybody to stay safe and stay home. We wanted teachers to continue to work, but make sure that they are also completing the duties that, you know, are entrusted in us. A lot of people trust us to teach their children, to keep them safe. And so we encouraged everybody to stay home and stay safe and continue working. Recently, we had a joint statement that was released between our district and our union, urging the Texas Education Agency to allow us a little bit more flexibility in how funding works and making sure that everyone is able to work with accommodations that is best for themselves and their families.
Mario, there's been some flip-flopping the past couple weeks from the state and the district in terms of in-person teaching. What was that all about?
Yeah, so ultimately it all comes down to funding. The state is telling us that to get fully funded, like a normal year student, we need to offer some kind of options for students to be in person. I understand that a lot of parents want their students to come in person because that's the way they learn the best. But I think we're in a very unique situation, and we need to take that into account. So unfortunately, if we go 100% remote, which in my opinion is the best thing to do, the most safest thing to do, we run the risk of not being fully funded, which means that teachers will have to make up time that they've already worked.
Texas is a right-to-work state, which can undercut the union in their collective bargaining power. How has that affected the tensions here between the union and the district, Mario?
For us, because we are a right-to-work state, it's always kind of been difficult to hold a whole lot of leverage. We're very blessed in Austin that our union has a consultation contract, which effectively allows us to collectively bargain. We recently got a new superintendent, so we're still kind of learning to work with each other, getting to know each other, seeing how we can work together, because every relationship with the superintendent is different.
What does all this mean for your students, Mario?
I think it's quite a conundrum, right? Because I work in a community where it's not an affluent neighborhood, our students and our parents really are having to make the decision. Do they stay home and stay safe, which is probably the best option? Or do they send their kids so they can go to work one day? Or do they stay go to work and let their kids stay unattended if needed? It's definitely affecting our Black and brown neighborhoods just a little bit more, because not all of them have the resources to have their students stay home. Not all of them have the resources to have someone take care of them. And so they're having to make a decision between their health and their livelihoods.
How do you see the next couple of weeks playing out and months playing out now that many of the students are back in school for in-person learning?
I think we've seen on a couple of occasions across America that with students coming back, inevitably cases are going to rise. And that's really disheartening, because the last thing that any teacher wants to do is harm or put themselves or their students or even their own family in jeopardy.
Mario Pena is an 8th grade English teacher in Austin, Texas. Mario, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we've also been hearing from parents and teachers around the country. If your school district is open or planning to reopen for in-person learning, how do you feel about that decision?
My name is Parker, and I teach 6th grade in a public school district. The district that I currently work in is the last district in my area to go back to in-person learning. When I think about coming back, I think about the logistics and the science, and it makes me really nervous thinking about people's grandparents and the transmission and all that. But I also feel really excited when I think about being able to be in front of my students and have them face to face and give them all the benefits that they need and deserve.
And we want to keep hearing from you about your local school district, so send us a voice memo to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Or go to thetakeaway.org and click on Contact Us to record your answer straight into your computer or phone. And we're going to continue our conversation about the rising tension between teachers, unions, and school districts over when to start in-person learning and how to keep students and teachers safe. As we heard earlier, teachers in Chicago, which is the 3rd largest school district in the nation, were supposed to return to in-person learning on February 1st, but on Sunday, members of the Chicago Teachers Union voted to remain remote until more vaccinations and virus protections are available. With similar disputes nationwide over when to return to the classroom playing out across the country, President Biden and the Departments of Education and Health and Human Services are working on a national plan and some guidance to help school districts and teachers come to terms on these difficult decisions. Kaylin Belsha is a national reporter for Chalkbeat, and Kaylin joins me now to talk about all this. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So we heard about what's happening in Chicago. Teachers are saying they don't want to return to the classroom. What about teachers' unions across the country? We've also heard from a teacher in Austin where they don't have as much bargaining power there. Are you seeing common issues, Kaylin?
Yes, I think, you know, Chicago has kind of become a symbol for the like larger reopening debate, and the availability of the vaccine has kind of complicated that. I think, you know, in places that have not gone back for in-person learning yet, we are seeing more calls to kind of tie reopening to the availability of the vaccine for educators. That's one thing. We're also starting to see bubble up a lot more calls for widespread testing of staff and students. The president of the American Federation of Teachers, that's the 2nd largest teachers union, has said that's what we should be focusing on, is kind of more widespread testing, in addition to lots of building changes. So making sure that there's proper ventilation and that people have the PPE that they need. So those are some of the big things that we're seeing asked for right now.
You know, before the pandemic, we've reported a lot on The Takeaway about how teachers across the country were striking for better conditions, for better pay. Do you suspect that that could happen this time around with the COVID-19 protocols being different in different places? Could unions strike nationally?
So there's definitely different rules about when you can and can't strike. I mean, in Chicago, there's the possibility that they could strike. But I think it's kind of unclear. A lot of folks are already back teaching in buildings. And so I think it's kind of hard to put that back in the bottle. So I think what we might see are kind of more calls for that testing and for more things to be in writing. I mean, a lot of places have been kind of adding on to their agreements as time goes on. And there are plenty of school districts that are not back yet that are still negotiating. I think Los Angeles is a really good example of that. And they're saying, you know, even the availability of the vaccine may not be enough, and that they want things like lower transmission rates and lower infection rates. So I think that kind of remains to be seen if we're going to see widespread strikes and walkouts.
There are so many sides to this story. We know that parents, maybe not all parents, but some parents across the country say they need to have their kids in school for in-person learning. When you talk to parents, what are they telling you?
Yeah, I think it's a real mix. I think there are many African-American and Hispanic parents that are still pretty scared to send their kids back into school. I've talked with many who say, you know, we want to see how the vaccine rollout goes. We're okay to stay remote for now for safety purposes. And then there are other parents that say, no, I want my kids back in school. And the kind of larger back and forth with the unions is complicating that. I think there are many parents who are sympathetic to what teachers want. They're asking for more safety protocols and more testing, which could benefit their students too. So I think it's kind of all over the map how parents are feeling right now.
Are there specific school ages that are more contested than others? For example, are you noticing more tension between going elementary school teachers who may not want to return versus high school teachers, or teachers that work with special needs students, or is it just across the board?
I think it's across the board, but right now we're seeing much more focus on the younger students going back to school in person. And even as part of the Biden administration's plan, the promise is really to reopen K-8 schools. There's been a lot less talk about bringing back high schoolers. And I know that there's kind of a larger narrative of like, well, what are we going to do with those students? And I think, you know, it's not really clear yet. So I think the high school teachers are not quite as much in the mix, partly because there's been less calls to bring those students back in person.
Talk to us a little bit about Biden's plan. You said it focuses mostly on K through 8 students. What else is it meant to do? And we should note that President Biden's wife is a doctor of education. So this is something that's very close to his own heart and family.
Yeah, so as part of the flurry of executive orders that were signed last week, there's one specifically focused on trying to reopen more K-8 schools. And so they promised that they're going to do more testing and more vaccination availability for people in general, as well as educators. So the hope is that will help with reopening for in-person learning. Then there's also the promise that there will be some kind of national metrics and kind of recommendations to help clarify what people should be looking toward. I think there's been massive confusion of what public health metrics should be used, and when should schools be open, when should they be hybrid, when should they be closed. That's very basic. And then there's also...
Kaylin, you're talking there about like infection rates, like if they reach a certain percentage, schools close, right?
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of kind of school administrators asking for just more guidance of like, what should I be looking for? What is the right public health metric? Because I'm using many different ones depending on what state I'm in, and people want just some clarity on like, what is the right one to use? And then I think just in general, more data about who's even open and who's even closed. We don't even know that as a country. And so the Biden administration has promised to do more tracking around opening and closing, and also what harms have happened to students because of the closures.
And Kaylin, have teachers been prioritized in some of these vaccine efforts across the country? I know there's been a lot of confusion about who should get what first, but are teachers part of those groups generally?
Yeah, it varies from state to state, but we are seeing educators fall into the essential workers group in many states. I think the problem has been that the supply is very low, and so often they're kind of grouped with first responders like police officers and firefighters, and so there might not be availability of vaccines. We're starting to see school districts kind of partner directly with hospitals and health systems to try to get their staff vaccinated, and part of the pressure that unions are putting on states and others right now is to try to bump educators up the list if they're falling in the middle. So some are prioritizing them and some are not, and I'm kind of putting them in the middle.
It's interesting. We're going to see how this all plays out as we head into the second year of this pandemic. Kaylin Belsha is a national reporter for Chalkbeat. Kaylin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
One of the most common symptoms of COVID-19, particularly for people with more mild cases, is losing your sense of smell. Many people say they regain the sense within weeks, but others can go nearly a year without getting it back. And while the symptom is less life-threatening than other aspects of the coronavirus, it's frequently connected to a loss of taste and overall appetite among COVID-19 patients, and it can have real consequences for people's lives. Tejal Rao is the California restaurant critic at the New York Times, who recently wrote about losing her sense of smell after getting COVID-19 and the flavors she sought out in an attempt to enjoy the experience of eating again. Tejal, thanks for being with us.
Oh, hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I cannot imagine. I have lost my sense of taste and smell with something non-COVID-19 related. So I can't imagine doing what you do and losing that. How did you first realize that you couldn't smell?
Well, I realized it immediately. It was one of the first symptoms that I experienced. And as soon as it happened, you know, now we're at the point in the pandemic where I think if you lose your sense of smell, it's a bit of a red flag. So I immediately scheduled a test. But I had recently adopted a new dog who gets a little stinky outside. I couldn't smell her. I couldn't smell the hand soap as I was washing my hands. And it wasn't the same as, you know, when you have a cold and things are a little bit muted. It was a complete blank. It was really quite scary.
And what about your sense of taste?
Right. So smell and taste are so intimately connected. I could still taste saltiness, sourness, like at a very basic level, but without smells kind of informing me of all the details, it was almost nothing. So eating became, you know, really lifeless and normally brings me so much joy and so much pleasure as a food writer. And I just couldn't find any of that, not even with the foods I would consider my comfort foods when I'm sick, you know, like chicken soup, really good homemade chicken soup, or congee, dal and rice. Even those really comforting things just didn't have anything to offer me.
You actually wrote a piece in October where you documented some of the smells you experience every day in Los Angeles. And how did working on that piece make you think about the role that the sense of smell plays in our daily lives? Because I think people sort of take it for granted.
Yeah, exactly. That's part of why I wrote the piece, is that, you know, we're smelling our nose and our brain, really. Our brains are working to interpret smells around us all the time. And they keep us safe. You know, we smell a gas leak, or we smell smoke from a fire. And they also just are giving us information about our surroundings all the time. And I wanted to document everything in a day, from the, you know, the smells pumped out by the industrial bakery down the street to, I'm in Los Angeles, so the smell of like coyote mint and sagebrush in the air sometimes, skunks, you know, the good smells and the bad smells, everything.
And the sense of smell also helps us keep us safe.
Yeah. Exactly. And that can be really disorienting. You know, I'm really lucky because I experienced this short-term loss, but people who are completely without their sense of smell, it can be dangerous. You know, frankly, it can be really dangerous because smell is a big part of how we understand what's going on around us. It's a little bit like wearing blinders if you can't smell what's happening around you.
You wrote a piece very recently about turning to Sichuan flavors to regain some sense of taste. Why?
Well, you know, in part, those comfort foods I mentioned weren't bringing me a lot of joy, and I was losing my appetite, which is very rare for me. And so Sichuan peppercorns, it's not, you know, they didn't help me regain my sense of taste, but they gave me the feeling of tasting. There's a molecule in Sichuan peppercorns. It's called hydroxy alpha sensual, and it creates, when you eat the peppercorns, this buzzing feeling through your mouth and lips. So even though you're not necessarily tasting the really beautiful floral flavors of the peppercorns that are usually there, I was picking up that buzz, that hum, and it made me feel, it honestly just made me feel alive again after being isolated and not having an appetite. And in combination with the dried chilies, so there was this very gentle burn of chili, and then followed by the tingly feeling from the peppercorns, and then the burn again from the chili, and it just it kind of woke me up again. It made me feel good, even though it didn't actually restore my sense of taste.
Is your sense of taste and smell, are they back 100%, or would you say they're still lingering?
It's still lingering. So I'm not at 100% yet, but I can pick up scents in the air again. My partner was boiling tea this morning, and I can smell the ginger and the black tea in the air. So I'm doing a lot better than I was when I filed this piece a few weeks ago.
You wrote about worrying that you might not be able to do your job anymore after losing your sense of smell. Are you still concerned about that?
I was really concerned about it a couple weeks ago, and now I'm starting to feel a little bit more confident that my sense of smell will return, and not just return, but return and be clear again, because I think for a lot of people who suffer from anosmia, that the smells are mixed up, you know, your brain isn't processing them properly, and I was very worried about that. And I'm not a perfumer. Smell isn't the most important part of my work, but it's crucial. It's really crucial, and I'm hoping to get back to reviewing soon.
Lots of folks who have gotten the virus have also reported these symptoms. Do you have any advice for people who are still experiencing that loss of smell and taste after getting COVID-19?
Oh, it's so personal, but I think bringing smells to yourself every day to see if you can recognize them is helpful. I was using spices and essential oils, and it's disheartening every time you kind of stick your nose in like coffee beans and nothing reads and it's a blank. But when you are able to pick up a little bit, it can make you feel really excited again and really positive if you're lucky enough to regenerate those neurons and start to smell again.
Tejal, are you excited to smell something specific right now?
Oh gosh. the frying garlic was the thing that really, I was just cooking for myself, and when I was cooking and couldn't smell anything, it was awful. But the first day that I could smell frying garlic, it was, it made me, I called my mother. I was so excited. I called my parents to tell them. Yeah.
That's wonderful. We wish you all the wonderful smells and tastes. Tejal Rao is the California restaurant critic at the New York Times and columnist for the New York Times Magazine. Tejal, thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for tuning in. Call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet. We're at The Takeaway. You can also send us your voice memos, record them on your phone, and email them to takeawaycallers@gmail.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.